With Wolf in Canada, The Winning of a Continent by G. A. Henty. Chapter 1. A Rescue. Most of the towns standing on our seacoast have suffered a radical change in the course of the last century. Railroads and the fashion of summer holiday-making have transformed them altogether, and great towns have sprung up where fishing villages once stood. There are a few places, however, which seem to have been passed by the crowd. The number yearly becomes smaller as the iron roads throw out fresh branches. With the advent of these come the speculative builder. Rows of terraces and shops are run up. Promenades are made. Bathing machines and brass bands become familiar objects. And in a few years, the original character of the place altogether disappears. Sidmouth, for a long time, was passed by the world of holiday-makers. East and west of her great changes took place, and many far smaller villages became fashionable seaside watering-places. The railway, which passed by some 12 miles away, carried its tens of thousands westward, but left few of them in Sidmouth, and anyone who visited the pretty little place 15 years back would have seen it almost as it stood when our story opens a century ago. There are few places in England with a fairer sight. It lies embosomed in the hills which rise sharply on either side of it, while behind stretches a rich, undulating country, thickly dotted with orchards and snug homesteads, with lanes bright with wild flowers and ferns, with high hedges and trees meeting overhead. The cold breezes which render so bare of interest the walks round the great majority of our seaside towns pass harmlessly over the valley of the Sid, where the vegetation is as bright and luxuriant as if the ocean lay leagues away, instead of breaking on the shore within a few feet of the front line of houses. The cliffs which on either side rise from the water's edge are neither white, like those to the east, nor gray, as are the rugged bulwarks to the west. They are of a deep red, warm and pleasant to the eye, with clumps of green showing brightly up against them on every little ledge where vegetation can get a footing. While the beach is neither pebble, nor rock, nor sand, but a smooth, level surface, sloping evenly down, hard and pleasant to walk on when the sea has gone down and the sun has dried and baked it for an hour or two, but slippery and treacherous when freshly wetted, for the red cliffs are of clay. Those who sail past in a boat would hardly believe that this is so, for the sun has baked its face, and the wind dried it till it is cracked and seamed, and makes a brave imitation of red granite. But the clammy ooze when the sea goes down tells its nature only too plainly, and Sidmouth will never be a popular watering place for children, for there is no digging sandcastles here, and a fall will stain light dresses and pinafores a ruddy hue, and the young laborers will look as if they had been at work in a brick field. But a century since, the march of improvement had nowhere begun, and there were few larger and no prettier seaside villages on the coast than Sidmouth. It was an afternoon in August. The sun was blazing down hotly. Scarce a breath of wind was stirring, and the tiny waves broke along the shore with a low rustle like that of falling leaves. Some fishermen were at work re-caulking a boat hauled up on the shore. Others were laying out some nets to dry in the sun. Some fisher boys were lying asleep like dogs basking in the heat, and a knot of lads sitting under the shade of a boat were discussing with some warmth the question of smuggling. "What do you say to it, Jim Walsham?" one of the party said, looking up at a boy some 12 years old, who was leaning against a boat, but who had hitherto taken no part in the discussion. "There is no doubt that it's wrong," the boy said. "Not wrong like stealing and lying and that sort of thing. Still, it's wrong because it's against the law. And the revenue men, if they come upon a gang landing the tubs, fight with them. And if any are killed, they are not blamed for it. So there is no doubt about its being wrong. Then, on the other hand, no one thinks any the worse of the men that do it, and there is scarce a one, gentle or simple, as won't buy some of the stuff if he gets a chance. so it can't be so very wrong. It must be great fun to be a smuggler, to be always dodging the king's cutters and running cargoes under the nose of the officers ashore. There is some excitement in a life like that.
There's plenty of excitement in fishing, one of the boys said sturdily. If you had been out in that storm last March, you would have had as much excitement as you liked. For 12 hours we expected to go down every minute, and we were half our time bailing for our lives.
An approving murmur broke from the others, who were all, with the exception of the one addressed as Jim Walsham, of the Fisher class. His clothing differed but little from that of the rest. His dark blue pilot trousers were old and sea-stained. His hands and face were dyed brown with exposure to the sun and the salt water. But there was something in his manner and tone of voice which showed that a distinction existed. James Walsham was indeed the son of the late doctor of the village, who had died 2 years previously. Dr. Walsham had been clever in his profession, but circumstances were against him. Sidmouth and its neighborhood were so healthy that his patients were few and far between, and when he died of injuries received from being thrown over his horse's head when the animal one night trod on a stone coming down the hill into Sidmouth, his widow and son were left almost penniless. Mrs. Walsham was fortunately an energetic woman, and a fortnight after her husband's death she went round among the tradesmen of the place and the farmers of the neighborhood and announced her intention of opening a school for girls. She had received a good education, being the daughter of a clergyman, and she soon obtained enough pupils to enable her to pay her way and to keep up the pretty home in which her husband lived in the outskirts of Sidmouth. If she would have taken boarders, she could have obtained far higher terms, for good schools were scarce, but this she would not do, and her pupils all lived within distances where they could walk backwards and forwards to their homes. Her evenings she devoted to her son, and though the education which she was enabled to give him would be considered meager indeed in these days of universal cramming, he learned as much as the average boy of the period. He would have learned more had he followed her desires and devoted the time when she was engaged in teaching to his books, but this he did not do. For a few hours in the day he would work vigorously at his lessons. The rest of his time he spent either on the seashore or in the boats of the fishermen, and he could swim, row, or handle a boat under sail in all weather, as well or better than any lad in the village of his own age. His disposition was a happy one, and he was a general favorite among the boatmen. He had not as yet made up his mind as to his future. His mother wanted him to follow his father's profession. He himself longed to go to sea, but he had promised his mother that he would never do so without her consent, and that consent he had no hope of obtaining. The better-class people in the village shook their heads gravely over James Walsham and prophesied no good things of him. They considered that he demeaned himself greatly by association with the fisher boys, and more than once he had fallen into disgrace with the more quiet-minded of the inhabitants by mischievous pranks. His reputation that was once established, every bit of mischief in the place, which could not be clearly traced to someone else, was put down to him, and as he was not one who would peach upon others to save himself, he was seldom in a position to prove his innocence. The parson had once called upon Mrs. Walsham and had talked to her gravely over her son's delinquencies, but his success had not been equal to his anticipations. Mrs. Walsham had stood up warmly for her son. "The boy may get into mischief sometimes, Mr. Allenby, but it is the nature of boys to do so. James is a good boy, upright and honorable, and would not tell a lie under any consideration. What is he to do? If I could afford to send him to a good school, it would be a different thing, but that you know I cannot do. From 9 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon my time is occupied by teaching, and I cannot expect, nor do I wish, that he should sit moping indoors all day. He had far better be out in the boats with the fishermen than be hanging about the place doing nothing. If anything happened to me before he is started in life, there would be nothing for him but to take to the sea.
I am laying by a little money every month, and if I live for another year, there will be enough to buy him a fishing boat and nets. I trust that it may not come to that, but I see nothing derogatory in his earning an honest living with his own hands. He will always be something better than a common fisherman. The education I have striven to give him, and his knowledge that he was born a gentleman, will nerve him to try and rise. As to what you say about mischief, so far as I know, all boys are mischievous. I know that my own brothers were always getting into scrapes, and I have no doubt, Mr. Allenby, that when you look back upon your own boyhood, you will see that you were not an exception to the general rule. Mr. Allenby smiled. He had come rather against his own inclinations, but his wife had urged him to speak to Mrs. Walsham, her temper being ruffled by the disappearance of two favorite pigeons, whose loss she, without a shadow of evidence, most unjustly put down to James Walsham. The parson was by no means strict with his flock. He was a tall man, inclined to be portly, a good shot, and an ardent fisherman. And although he did not hunt, he was frequently seen on his brown cob at the meet, whenever it took place within a reasonable distance of Sidmouth. And without exactly following the hounds, his knowledge of the country often enabled him to see more of the hunt than those who did. As Mrs. Walsham spoke, the memory of his old school and college days came across him. "That is the argumentum ad hominem, Mrs. Walsham, and when a lady takes to that, we can say no more. You know I like your boy. There is much that is good in him. But it struck me that you were letting him run a little too wild. However, there is much in what you say, and I don't believe that he is concerned in half the mischief that he gets credit for. Still, you must remember that a little of the curb, just a little, is good for us all. It spoils a horse to be always tugging at his mouth, but he will go very badly if he does not feel that there is a hand on the reins. I have said the same thing to the squire. He spoils that boy of his, for whom, between ourselves, I have no great liking. The old man will have trouble with him before he's done, or I am greatly mistaken." Nothing came of Mr. Allenby's visit. Mrs. Walsham told James that he had been there to remonstrate with her. "I do not want to stop you from going out sailing, Jim, but I wish you would give up your mischievous pranks. They only get you bad will and a bad name in the place. Many people here think that I am wrong in allowing you to associate so much with the fisher boys, and when you get into scrapes it enables them to impress upon me how right they were in their forecasts. I do not want my boy to be named in the same breath with those boys of Robeson's or young Peterson or Blaine." "But you know I have nothing to do with them, Mother," James said indignantly. "They spend half their time about the public house, and they do say that when Peterson has been out with that lurcher of his, he has been seen coming back with his coat bulged out, and there is often a smell of hair round his father's cottage at supper time. You know I wouldn't have anything to do with them." "No, Jim, I'm sure you would not. But if people mix up your name with theirs, it is almost as bad for you as if you had. Unfortunately, people are too apt not to distinguish between tricks which are really only the outcome of high spirit and a lack of something better to do, and real vice. Therefore, Jim, I say keep yourself from mischief. I know that though you are out of doors so many hours of the day, you really do get through a good deal of work. But other people do not give you credit for this. Remember how your father was respected here. Try to act always as you would have done had he been alive, and you cannot go far wrong." James had done his best, but he found it hard to get rid of his reputation for getting into mischief, and more than once, when falsely suspected, he grumbled that he might just as well have the fun of the thing, for he was sure to have the blame. As James Walsham and his companions were chatting in the shade of a boat, their conversation was abruptly broken off by the sight of a figure coming along the road. It was a tall figure with a stiff military bearing. He was pushing before him a large box, mounted on a framework, supported by four wheels. Low down, close to the ground, swung a large, flat basket. In this, on a shawl spread over a thick bed of hay, sat a little girl, some 5 years old. "It's the sergeant!" one of the boys exclaimed. "I wonder whether he's got a fresh set of views. The last were first-rate ones." The sergeant gave a friendly nod to the boys as he passed, and then, turning up the main street from the beach, went along until he came to a shaded corner, and there stopped. The boys had all got up and followed him, and now stood looking on with interest at his proceedings. The little girl had climbed out of her basket as soon as he stopped, and after asking leave, trotted back along the street to the beach, and was soon at play among the seaweed and stones. She was a singularly pretty child, with dark blue eyes and brown hair with a touch of gold. Her print dress was spotlessly clean and neat. A huge flapping sunbonnet shaded her face, whose expression was bright and winning.
"Well, boys," the sergeant said cheerfully, "how have you been getting on since I was here last? Nobody drowned, I hope, or came to any ill? Not that we must grumble, whatever comes. We have all got to do our duty, whether it be to march up a hill with shot and shell screaming and whistling round, as I have had to do, or to be far out at sea with the wind blowing fit to take the hair off your head, as comes to your lot sometimes, or following the plough from year's end to year's end, as happens to some. We have got to make the best of it, whatever it is. I've got a grand new set of pictures from Exeter. They came all the way down from London town for me by wagon. London Bridge and Windsor Castle with the flag flying over it, telling that the king, God bless his gracious majesty, is at home. Then I have got some pictures of foreign parts that will make your eyes open. There's Niagara. I don't know whether you've heard of it, but it's a place where a great river jumps down over a wall of rock as high as that steeple there, with a roar like thunder that can be heard, they say, on a still night for 20 miles round. I have got some that will interest you more still because you are sailors, or are going to be sailors. I have got one of the killing of a whale. He had just thrown a boat with 5 sailors into the air with a lash of his tail. But it's of no use, for there are other boats round, and the harpoons are striking deep in his flesh. He is a big fish and a strong one, but he will be beaten, for he does not know how to use his strength. That's the case with many men. They throw away their life and their talents just because they don't know what's in them and what they might do if they tried. And I have got a picture of a fight with the Spanish Armada. You've heard about that, boys, surely, for it began out there over the water almost in sight of Sidmouth, and went on all the way up the channel, our little ships hanging on to the great Spaniards and giving them no rest, but worrying them and battering them till they were glad to sail away to the Dutch coast. But they were not safe there, for we sent fireships at them, and they had to cut and run, and then a storm came on and sunk many and drove others ashore all round our coasts, even round the north of Scotland and Ireland. You will see it all here, boys, and as you know, the price is only 1 penny. By this time the sergeant had let down one side of the box and discovered 4 round holes and had arranged a low stool in front for any of those who were not tall enough to look through the glasses to stand upon. A considerable number of girls and boys had now gathered round, for Sergeant Wilkes and his show were old established favorites at Sidmouth, and the news of his arrival had traveled quickly round the place. 4 years before, he had appeared there for the first time, and since then he had come every few months. He travelled round the southwestern counties, Dorset and Wilts, Somerset, Devon, and Cornwall, and his cheery good temper made him a general favourite wherever he went. He was somewhat of a martinet, and would have no crowding and pushing, and always made the boys stand aside till the girls had a look. But he never hurried them, and allowed each an ample time to see the pictures, which were of a better class than those in most travelling peep shows. There was some murmuring at first, because the show contained none of the popular murders and blood-curdling scenes to which the people were accustomed. "No," the sergeant said firmly, when the omission was suggested to him. "The young ones see quite enough scenes of drunkenness and fighting. When I was a child, I remember seeing in a peep show the picture of a woman lying with her head nearly cut off, and her husband with a bloody chopper standing beside her, and it spoiled my sleep for weeks. No, none of that sort of thing for Sergeant Wilkes. He has fought for his country, and has seen bloodshed enough in his time, and the ground itself half covered with dead and dying men, but that was his duty.
this is pleasure.
Sergeant Wilkes will show the boys and girls who pay him their pennies views in all parts of the world, such as would cost them thousands of pounds if they travelled to see them, and all as natural as life. He will show them great battles by land and sea, where the soldiers and sailors shed their blood like water in the service of their country. But cruel murders and notorious crimes he will not show them.
It was not the boys and girls only who were the sergeant's patrons. Picture books were scarce in those days, and grown-up girls and young men were not ashamed to pay their pennies to peep into the sergeant's box. There was scarcely a farmhouse throughout his beat where he was not known and welcomed. His care of the child, who, when he first came round, was but a year old, won the heart of the women, and a bowl of bread and milk for the little one, and a mug of beer and a hunch of bread and bacon for himself, were always at his service before he opened his box and showed its wonders to the maids and children of the house. Sidmouth was one of his regular halting places, and indeed he visited it more often than any other town on his beat. There was always a room ready for him there in the house of a fisherman's widow when he arrived on the Saturday, and he generally stopped till the Monday. Thus he had come to know the names of most of the boys of the place, as well as of many of the elders. For it was his custom of a Saturday evening, after the little one was in bed, to go and smoke his pipe in the tap-room of the Anchor, where he would sometimes relate tales of his adventures to the assembled fishermen. But although chatty and cheery with his patrons, Sergeant Wilkes was a reticent rather than a talkative man. At the Anchor he was, except when called upon for a story, a listener rather than a talker. As to his history, or the county to which he belonged, he never alluded to it, although communicative enough as to his military adventures, and any questions which were asked him he quietly put on one side. He had intimated, indeed, that the father and mother of his grandchild were both dead, but it was not known whether she was the child of his son or daughter, for under his cheerful talk there was something of military strictness and sternness, and he was not a man of whom idle questions would be asked. "Now, boys and girls," he said, "step up. The show is ready. Those who have got a penny cannot spend it better. Those who haven't must try and get their father or mother to give them one and see the show later on. Girls first. Boys should always give way to their sisters. The bravest men are always the most courteous and gentle with women." Four girls of various ages paid their pennies and took their places at the glasses, and the sergeant then began to describe the pictures, his descriptions of the wonders within being so exciting that several boys and girls stole off from the little crowd and made their way to their homes to coax their parents out of the necessary coin. James Walsham listened a while, and then walked away to the sea, for there would be several sets of girls before it came to the turn of the boys. He strolled along, and as he came within sight of the beach, stopped for a moment suddenly, and then with a shout ran forward at the top of his speed. The little girl, after playing some time with the seaweed, had climbed into a small boat which lay at the edge of the advancing tide, and leaning over the stern watched the little waves as they ran up one after another. A few minutes after she had got into it, the rising tide floated the boat, and it drifted out a few yards as far as its head rope allowed it. Ignorant of what had happened, the child was kneeling up at the stern, leaning over and dabbling her hands in the water. No one had noticed her. The boys had all deserted the beach. None of the fishermen were near the spot. Just before James Walsham came within sight of the sea, the child had overbalanced itself. His eye fell on the water just as two arms and a frightened little face appeared above it. There was a little splash and a struggle, and the sea was bare again. At the top of his speed, James dashed across the road, sprang down the beach, and rushing a few yards into the water, dived down. He knew which way the tide was making and allowed for the set. A few vigorous strokes, and he reached something white on the surface. It was the sunbonnet, which had, in the child's struggles, become unfastened. He dived at once, and almost immediately saw a confused mass before him. Another stroke, and he seized the child's clothes, and grasping her firmly, rose to the surface and swam towards shore. Although the accident had not been perceived, his shout and sudden rush into the water had called the attention of some of the men, and two or three of them ran into the water waist-deep to help him out with his little burden. "Well done, Master Walsham. The child could have been drowned if you had not seen it. None of us noticed her fall over. She was playing on the beach last time I seed her."
"Is she dead?" James asked, breathless from his exertions.
"Not she," the fisherman said. "She could not have been under water a minute. Take her into my cottage. It's one of the nighest. My wife will put her between the blankets, and will soon bring her round."
The fisherman's wife met them at the door, and taking the child from the lad, carried it in, and soon had her wrapped up in blankets. But before this was done she had opened her eyes, for she had scarcely lost consciousness when James had seized her. The lad stood outside the door waiting for the news when the sergeant hurried up, one of the fishermen having gone to tell him what had happened as soon as the child had been carried into the cottage, assuring him as he did so that the little one would speedily come round. Just as he came up, the door of the cottage opened, and one of the women who had run in to assist the fisherman's wife put her head out.
"She has opened her eyes," she said. "The little dear will soon be all right."
"Thank heaven for his mercies," the sergeant said, taking off his hat. "What should I have done if I had lost her? And I have to thank you next to God," he said, seizing the boy's hand. "May God bless you, young gentleman, and reward you for having saved my darling. They tell me she must have been drowned but for you, for no one knew she had fallen in. Had it not been for you, I should come round to look for her, and she would have been gone, gone for ever." And the showman dashed the tears from his eyes with the back of his hand.
"I was only just in time," the lad said. "I did not see her fall out of the boat. She was only a few yards away from it when she came up, just as my eyes fell on the spot. I am very glad to have saved her for you, but of course it was nothing of a swim. She could not have been many yards out of my depth. Now I will run home and change my things."
James Walsham was too much accustomed to be wet through to care anything about his dripping clothes. But they served him as an excuse to get away, for he felt awkward, embarrassed at the gratitude of the old soldier. He pushed his way through the little crowd, which had now gathered round, and started at a run, for the news had brought almost all those gathered around the peep show to the shore, the excitement of somebody being drowned being superior even to that of the peep show to the great majority, though a few, who had no hope of obtaining the necessary pennies, had lingered behind and seized the opportunity for a gratuitous look through the glasses. James ran upstairs and changed his clothes without seeing his mother, and then, taking down one of his lesson books, set to work, shrinking from the idea of going out again and being made hero of. Half an hour later there was a knock at the front door, and a few minutes after his mother called him down. He ran down to the parlor, and there found the showman.
"Oh, I say," the boy broke out, "don't say anything more about it. I do hate being thanked, and there was nothing in swimming 10 yards in a calm sea. Please don't say anything more about it. I would rather you hit me ever so much."
The sergeant smiled gravely, and Mrs. Walsham exclaimed,
"Why didn't you come in and tell me about it, Jim? I could not make out at first what Mr.
Sergeant Wilkes, madam. What Sergeant Wilkes meant when he said that he had called to tell me how grateful he felt to you for saving his little grandchild's life. I am proud of you, Jim."
"Oh, mother, don't," the boy exclaimed. "It is horrid going on so. If I had swum out with a rope through the surf, there might be something in it, but just to jump in at the edge of the water is not worth making a fuss about one way or the other."
"Not to you, perhaps, young gentleman, but it is to me," the showman said. "The child is the light of my life, the only thing I have to care for in the world, and you have saved her. If it had only been by stretching out your hand, I should have been equally grateful. However, I will say no more about it, but I shall not think the less. But don't you believe, madam, that there was no credit in it. It was just the quickness and the promptness which saved her life. Had your son hesitated a moment, it would have been too late, for he would never have found her. It is not likely that your son will ever have any occasion for help of mine, but should there be an opportunity, he may rely upon it that any service I can render him shall be his to the death. And unlikely as it may seem, it may yet turn out that this brave act of his in saving the life of the granddaughter of a traveling showman will not be without its reward."
"Is she all right now?" James asked abruptly, anxious to change the conversation.
"Yes, she soon came to herself and wanted to tell me all about it, but I would not let her talk, and in a few minutes she dropped off asleep, and there I left her. The women tell me she will probably sleep till morning and will then be as well as ever.
and now I must go and look after my box, or the boys will be pulling it to pieces." It was, however, untouched, for in passing the sergeant had told the little crowd that if they left it alone, he would, on his return, let all see without payment, and during the rest of the afternoon he was fully occupied with successive audiences, being obliged to make his lectures brief in order that all might have their turn. After the sergeant had left, James took his hat and went for a long walk in the country, in order to escape the congratulations of the other boys. The next day little Agnes was perfectly well, and appeared with her grandfather in the seat far back in the church, which he always occupied on the Sundays he spent at Sidmouth. On these occasions she was always neatly and prettily dressed, and indeed some of the good women of the place, comparing the graceful little thing with their own children, had not been backward in their criticisms on the folly of the old showman in dressing his child out in clothes fit for a lady.